You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Conrad Bakker. He's in Illinois at the moment, about in Champaign, I believe. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd. I'm glad to be part of this.
Did I say that right, Urbana-Champaign? I love the way that sounds.
Yeah, Urbana-Champaign or Champaign-Urbana. It's a college town of two cities, so yes.
For some reason, it sounds nice together. I mean, I don't know. I don't know it well, but to me, that's has a nice flow to it. So tell me a little bit about what you're working on right now in your studio.
Well, I just got finished with a big project for a small French biennale, the Anglet, Basque Coast of France, international biennale. It is a kind of a public project where I built a sculpture of Henry David Thoreau's cabin from Walden, and it's actually a replica of the replica that they built at Walden Pond right now. That's there right now. It's a tourist destination, and so I decided to make a copy of this, and it's 1:1 scale, and it's sited on a small lake in an ecological preserve right on the coast of France in the city of Anglet. So that's kind of a big project that happened quickly, but is kind of where a lot of my energy was recently.
So let's talk about that a little bit before you go on. So that's really cool and an interesting kind of extension of your work, because it's, I mean, that scale even. But did you actually build that yourself to do the construction, or you hired a crew? And I'm kind of curious what it felt like inside there.
Well, I had to kind of plan it from a distance, because they provided the materials. They couldn't ship anything over, really. And they also provided an assistant that had access to tools and some equipment, and who had kind of helped me build it. It's kind of an intensive labor experiment, which I think is part of the project, in that I was interested in the way that Thoreau talks a lot about his own labor involved in building his house as some kind of feat of self-reliance, and thinking about the economy of that and the economy of labor. And so building it myself, the strain of it, I was actually something that I was interested in. And it's built like a cabin, but it's also not a cabin in that you can't go inside. It's kind of a frustrating object that can really only be imagined in terms of entering into, rather than actually entering into it.
Well, that's interesting. So then it changes what it is too, and it's also, I mean, there's the frame of it. Of course, it's an artwork. Maybe tell us a little bit about, how did this come to be? Was this part of a residency or a commissioned piece? It sounds like just such a lovely spot.
Yeah, it was. There's a bunch of works part of this biennale, and I've submitted it as a proposal to the curator Paul Arden, kind of related to, he was interested in certain ecological themes, kind of not just because of the ecological park there, but because of the coast and its relationship to kind of the way that the environment affects that part of France. But it's also a heavily constructed landscape, kind of not artificial, but it's not necessarily indigenous species of trees or whatever. It's kind of a constructed space. And so there's this environmental aspect, but then also a kind of an artificial aspect to that terrain. So I proposed it kind of in light of that, but it was also a project that I'd been wanting to do for a while. Something that, I mean, I've been interested in that object as a object of destination. It's kind of a symbolic thing, but it also is, cabins in general, and like tiny houses, are a hugely fetishized object in our culture as these kind of models of homes that we kind of are nostalgically wanting to go to get away from our homes or to remember ourselves or for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's true. It's very curious. So then tell us about what that was. That project just got finished, and that I imagine took a lot of time as well.
We were able to put it up in 2 weeks, so it actually was pretty quickly
wow.
going up.
It was pre-built or something, or it wasn't built? Or
no,
was built
no, no, we just built it. I mean, it wasn't, because we're not building a building, we essentially just could, we built a frame and then kind of carved into it as a way of making it a relief sculpture rather than building it to code. So it's code for buildings is different than code for sculptures sometimes.
Right. Hmm. Interesting. So tell me what you're working on, what else you're working on now.
I also have this ongoing project. I say ongoing because I started it and I have to finish it, but it's I didn't know it'd take this long. It's where I'm building, reconstructing Robert Smithson's library, where I'm remaking every single book that's listed as part of his library. The actual library is housed in the Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian. There's no one room. It's kind of boxed up, and you can have access to it piece by piece, but not really as a complete set. So I kind of think of my library, of his library, as kind of a surrogate, like one that one might be able to visit because one can't necessarily visit the actual library.
I love that. So these are all of you. You had a list of all of his books that were in his library. Is that what this is being drawn from? Like,
yeah. When he died, they thought his library was worth saving, and so they had someone document it and archive it. And it's been listed a couple times in his monographs as being, and there's been essays written about his library as being significant. And I think significant because of the range of his interests. It goes from science fiction to actual science, and from magic to poetry. And I think he was an interesting and well-read individual. So, and also not necessarily an academic. So there's a lot of that is in this collection of books.
No, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So how many, how are you assembling that, and how many volumes and where?
I'm assembling it piece by piece, and I have about a little bit more than half of it finished. There's 1,100 books, so maybe 1,200 books total. So piece by piece, meaning that I look up the books. The books come with some information in regards to like the publisher and the date of publication. And so I try and find online, using whatever resources I can, some examples of that book. And so I'm trying to get the right edition of the book, which means like the right cover, or the paperback versus hardcover.
Right.
Probably because I think that's important to kind of attempt to make physical the actual objects, but there's also a lot of errors that get thrown in the way because dimensions on that Amazon.com provides are not necessarily correct, or sometimes editions of books change quite frequently, so it's not easy to find the right one. And so some of the guesswork, some of the errors are built into the project as well as being kind of underlining that it's an attempt to build this surrogate library.
It's fascinating. I want to, it's such an attractive idea. I mean, I want to sit in that library and read the books. Is that what would eventually happen? I would be able to come and read them or no?
Well, because the books are all pieces of wood and paint, so they're inert objects, they're sculptures, and they are readily available. I mean, one can get all of these books from the library, or
right.
purchase them through some book collectors for the rare ones. But I like how in this case specifically, there's since out the library reveals something about the mind of Smithson on one hand,
right.
But there's also, because he lived only until 1973, there's this really great bracketing of that era, you know, from the in the 50s, 60s, and first couple of years of the 70s, where a lot of things were happening, and so it's a nice time capsule of what was there or what was available, and it's also interesting because it's idiosyncratic. We don't know if Smithson really owned all of these books, or if he was given some, or if he bought some for, you know, non-intellectual reasons, or, I mean, no one really reads their whole library. Libraries are often kind of embodiments of desire as much as they are actual collections of what we know or have read.
Mm. Yeah, sounds beautiful, really. I love that idea. You know, both of these ideas, you know, that you've discussed sound, of the recent work, sound very much kind of out of the marketplace, right? That these aren't things that people could easily acquire, although maybe they can. So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your practice and its relationship to the market, you know, because you also have made objects that could be bought or sold, and as I understand it. So how do you relate to that market, if you don't mind me asking, and how is your mm-hmm. career oriented that way? Because the two you just spoke about seem so out of the marketplace, in a sense.
Right, right. I mean, I'm very interested in the economies of art in general. And I do show traditionally in gallery spaces with objects that are for sale. But I also have a lot of projects that incorporate their value or perceived value into the work, where I try and make the object not only look like the thing that it's representing, but also kind of occupy the kind of value and commercial value of the object that it's representing. So I think of it
so,
as...
So an example of that, right? There's you've made examples of that specifically, right?
Yeah, like I made copies of Karl Marx's, the paperback version of Karl Marx's Capital, Volume 1. And if you were to buy it from Penguin, I mean, at the time when I did this, you could buy it from Penguin off their website for... £25, and so I made, I did a kind of an ordering project. Someone could order, if they gave me cash, pounds, £25, I would make them a copy of that same book. Thinking about the equivalency, you could buy the real book or you could buy the sculpture of the book, both of which occupy a lot of shelf space for most of their lives.
Right.
As, like, inert objects, really.
And so those are, I mean, examples of that. But so in terms of your, I mean, relationship to the art world, or maybe we should talk about support of a system like this.
Mm-hmm.
Are the works sold regularly, or do you care about that? Is that important to the process? I mean, it seems that it as we're talking, it's built into the, you know, almost the way we're thinking about consuming. But
mm-hmm.
but in terms of how your practice is.
Yeah, I mean, I like the range of economic possibilities where I have projects that are easily accessible in terms of price for almost anyone, and then there's other exhibitions that I'm part of where it's really catering to more of a collector-based audience or an art world audience. I'm interested in having that range. I mean, the same time I was doing that project with Marx's Capital, it was kind of coming out of an exhibition in London, a gallery that I was working with had a similar copy of that book, the sculpture of that book, and sold it at a gallery price, so it was a lot more. So the fact that both of those objects could exist in different economies, be similar but exist in different economies, I'm interested in how the objects, as physical things, they attempt to make those immaterial spaces or immaterial economies more tangible. So you can kind of, I'm hoping that they reveal the spaces and networks that they're part of for the people who participate.
I think they do. I mean, the example that you mentioned. It's great talking to you about your work. Is there another project we should talk about before we go? I'm worrying that I'm overlooking something important that you want to mention.
One aspect of the Robert Smithson Library Project is that it's also a book club, and this addresses the economy question too, because it's something that people can be part of. They can order one of the books from the library and I'll make a second copy of that book for them. And I think of it almost like a distributed archive where people participate either because there's books in that library that they are interested in as having as sculptures, or maybe they're interested in being part of the Smithson kind of ethos, or maybe it's whatever reasons that they have. But that's also been a nice way of thinking about the books more than just pertaining to Smithson, thinking about how books do live multiple lives, over the course of their existence. And they go to very different audiences and readers, or in this case, viewers.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So just to be clear, this club means people. You send them a book that they can read, or you're sending them a sculpture regularly.
A sculpture, and so it's fairly inexpensive. For $150, you can become part of the book club, and that. For that price, they receive a carved and painted book from Smithson's Library. And I only make one extra version of every book, so there's kind of a limited supply of titles available, depending on what's already been purchased.
Well, I love that. I'm so glad you mentioned that. And how does – I mean, we'll have links on the interview so people can – get to it, but can people do that all online, or how does someone go about that process?
I've exhibited it twice, and in those exhibitions there's been ways in which they have access to where there's order forms that people can either have or download, and there's also an online payment process now where I've kind of systematized it so it's a little bit easier for people to participate. And it's just a simple website where it just has pictures of the books that I've made so far, and those are the ones that are currently available, and the ones that are not available have reserved written on the front of them. And so it's kind of a nice visual display, but it does take a while to kind of scroll through all the books. There's a lot of books in that library, and it becomes kind of an overwhelming array after a while.
That's exciting. I love that. I'm going to look through them. I think I'd love to have one. Before we go, I want to ask you a final question. What is apropos? What books are you reading now, or book are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a lot. I teach here at the University of Illinois, so I'm reading a lot pertaining to the seminars and classes that I'm teaching. The one that I'm reading right now is actually, a Sternberg Press book, Art Production Beyond the Market, which is, it's not very interesting, but it relates to the subject matter that I'm teaching and thinking about and responsible for. I guess the other book that I've been more interested in reading is one of the latest by Richard Sennett. He had the book called The Craftsman, but his latest one kind of in that series is called Together, and it's about cooperation. But it's more than about cooperation. It's actually kind of going back to the subject of making and how making is not just a solitary act, but it's kind of a political, it's a political act of assertion, but it's also a connective act, and making together is kind of part of a series of relationships, and that's a simplification, but it's a beautiful book.
Well, it sounds beautiful, and I'll put a link to that as well if I can in this interview. I've been putting a few links in there for some books for our readers. So thank you so much. I want to thank you for taking the time with talking with me today and making the work you're doing.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.